Good morning, David Eason appearing on behalf of plaintiffs Trinidad Operations, Thomas Carlin, and Brenda and Peter Schrepfer in the case just called. The appellants in the case, as the court I'm sure is aware, did not request argument. We believe the briefs are sufficient for the court to make its decision. And so with the court's leave, I will make one or two basic comments and reserve the remainder of my time. Hopefully the briefs make clear on the appellant's side that we make two basic assertions of error. First, an assertion that the trial court erred in its assessment of the contract at issue, a loan agreement and bulk sale agreement. We believe the court erred in viewing its task purely as one of interpretation, overlooking the structure of the agreement and the presumption that arises as a matter of the law of contract based upon that structure. The structure in question is a single contract comprised of multiple agreements and interrelated promises. The presumption that arises is that the performances to be exchanged under that exchange of promises are to be treated and assumed to be conditions to each other, and thus the necessary corollary being that the performance of a promise being conditional on other promises is excused if there is an uncured material failure in the performance of a promise due at an earlier time. These rules are set forth encapsulated in sections 232 and 237 of the second restatement. 237 has been expressly invoked and relied upon by the Colorado Supreme Court in the cases cited. I believe the Zinke case is the case which uses that section, which is intimately linked to section 232. The court, we believe, because it approached the matter as one purely of interpretation, erred in ruling that the condition that the appellants asserted, to wit, that the payment of one loan was a condition to the payment of the loan that they were responsible for. The court erred in ruling that that condition had to be either expressly stated in the agreement or abundantly clear and implicit as a matter of fact and intent from the circumstances surrounding the agreement and the post hoc construction of the agreement placed by the parties through their conduct. That's an interpretive error. It's an error. It's a category error in treating as a matter of interpretation a matter that the law treats as a matter of presumption.
Mr. Eason, do you agree that there is no express provision for the condition that you assert as part of the contract?
We agree that the contract is, and assert it, that the contract is unambiguous and that there is no express language of condition, yes.
And on what basis do you say that it's implicit that there is such a condition?
Again, through the structure of the agreement. The agreement is structured as a series of promises exchanged by the parties on all sides. And in that structure, the law presumes that the promises create an exchange of performances that are conditional upon one another. This is section 232 of the restatement.
But wasn't the AMP promise to pay the note according to its terms predating the loan agreement by a year or two?
There was a promise that predated the loan agreement with and then was subsequently amended and altered in the loan agreement. So it essentially became a new promise.
You're saying that the alterations to the AMP note made in the loan agreement were the equivalent of a new promise to pay that note according to its terms?
Correct. And in addition, and as support for that, we point to the fact that essentially the note was paid down, was reduced by over $1 million through the new loan made through the loan agreement. I mean, one way to look at the loan agreement is our side took out a loan, and AMP, the obligor, the pre-existing obligor, whose obligation was restated, modified, altered, and it essentially became new, received the benefit of that loan.
Why do you say essentially became new?
Well, its maturity was I don't believe its maturity changed, but interest no longer accrued, the principal was restated and reduced, and it got other benefits associated with that change. So it we don't think it's, as a matter of law, possible to view it as a continuation of a pre-existing promise.
Are there any allegations of alter ego between the principal parties here FFP and Trinidad operations and their respective affiliates? I mean, why is it implicit that for AMP made any promises at all to FFP as opposed to Stone Ridge?
AMP's explicit promise was a promise to pay Stone Ridge, and to answer the court's question, no, we do not contend that these entities were alter egos of one another. What we do contend, and what the facts show, is they're very closely related. And as Mr. Powell testified, and his testimony is in the record, FFP was chosen as a vehicle for the funding of the loan because it was convenient to do so. The loan was, in fact, funded through another entity controlled by the controlling member of both AMP and FFP. But it was an explicit promise made by AMP in exchange for the alteration, the material alteration in its pre-existing agreement to pay the loan, that we say served as a promise exchanged for, in part, other promises, of course, were involved, the promise of the Trinidad operations people and guarantors, the people I represent, to pay their loan to FFP.
Mr. Eason, I guess I don't understand how it would be that if AMP had paid Stone Ridge, that your clients would have been able to access the money that Stone Ridge had received.
Well, again, the circumstance, this gets further into the circumstances in which the agreement was made, but it's undisputed that the agreement involved a single project of interrelated pieces of real estate, improvements, utilities, and the like. The payment by AMP of the Stone Ridge note was acknowledged by Mr. Powell, the manager of FFP and AMP, to allow Stone Ridge to pay other debt that it owed, which would free up borrowing capacity within the project and allow, in Mr. Powell's own words, the joint venture between Stone Ridge and AMP to proceed. So, again, this is part of the structure of the agreement. The agreement wasn't integrated through the incorporation and linking of these various different agreements for no reason. The agreement was integrated precisely because it dealt with a single project involving multiple parties that were all interrelated.
But even if it was a single project, on what basis did your clients have an expectation that money that Stone Ridge was to receive would be given to TOI?
That is not their expectation. Their expectation is that Stone Ridge would be paid, Stone Ridge would be able to relieve itself of debt, that would free up overall borrowing capacity within the project. The people involved in Trinidad operations are virtually identical to the people involved in Stone Ridge.
But if they're not alter egos, then I'm having trouble understanding the linkage between Stone Ridge and your clients.
Well, I don't know that I can articulate it any differently than I have. The Stone Ridge was an integral element of the project, as was Trinidad operations, as were the guarantors. If Stone Ridge is relieved of $3 million in debt because it is paid by AMP, then Stone Ridge has that much more capacity and ability to deal with other matters within the project. It is a single project, and these elements of it are interdependent and interrelated.
Which entity between Stone Ridge and operation?
All of them did. AMP held title, Stone Ridge held title, Trinidad operations held title.
What I'm trying to get to is if AMP's payment of the note increases Stone Ridge's borrowing capacity, which is your theory, how does that borrowing capacity make it easier for Trinidad operations to pay off the FFP note?
Stone Ridge could then assume certain liabilities of Trinidad operations. Stone Ridge could pay for other matters that would enhance the marketability of the project and therefore enhance project revenue. This is precisely why summary judgment's not appropriate. We were putting before the court a structural argument based upon the agreement and a factual argument essentially based upon formation defenses. We were not allowed to go try the case.
Are there documents in the record that explain what exactly the role of Stone Ridge in the project was and what exactly the role of Trinidad Operations in the project was, particularly as pertaining to obtaining credit and being able to pledge assets as security for additional credit.
Much of that information is contained in the agreement itself. It's contained in the affidavits that we supplied. It is contained in other documentary evidence presented in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. Is that all of the evidence available? Answer, no.
Well, briefly, just tell me, what was the difference in the role in the projects in the project between Stone Ridge and Trinidad Operations?
The basic difference, as I understand it, Your Honor, was that Stone Ridge was a developer of lots along with AMP. They were involved in essentially a joint development project with respect to certain residential lots in the project. Trinidad Operations was responsible for project infrastructure and development, and you can't have one without the other. And so if Stone Ridge has borrowing capacity that can be used to assume and or pay for certain elements of project infrastructure and other development that Trinidad Operations might otherwise have to pay for, then there is a relationship, obviously, between the borrowing capacity and financial wherewithal of Stone Ridge and Trinidad Operations.
Mr. Eason, let me switch gears for just a little bit and ask you a question about your affirmative defenses. Can you point me to what evidence there is in the record that indicates that AMP did not intend to honor its obligations at the time that all these agreements were entered into?
The evidence was developed through discovery, Your Honor, and it shows quite clearly the AMP had no money. It had no revenue.
At the time of formation, you're saying?
The contract was formed in 2008. At that time, the evidence shows AMP had minimal revenue, that it exhausted all of its 2008 revenue. It had no revenue going into 2009. The record also shows that AMP requested extension of the maturity of its obligation without disclosing that it had no wherewithal whatsoever.
But what evidence is there that they, of their intent, that they wouldn't pay their loan?
Well, it's circumstantial, but that we don't believe we need to show that. We believe all we needed to show was a duty to make disclosure. Look, understand, you're dealing with what is in essence a non-recourse entity. In other words, it has no capital of its own. It has no source of income or revenue apart from project income and revenue. And understand that that may be wildly insufficient to pay this note. If you want to go ahead on that basis, fine. But when parties are, in Mr. Powell's own words, a joint venture relationship, obviously confidential and fiduciary, there is clearly a duty to disclose. And our contention simply is that that is a defense to the contract because it's a flaw in formation.
Is your duty to disclose defense different from your mistake defense?
Yes, because the mistake defense does not depend upon any failure of disclosure. It depends upon a mistaken assumption that's basic to the agreement.
But what remedy do you want for your mistake defense? Is it reformation?
No, we don't want reformation. We think that the matter is thrown into equity. If the contract was not properly formed, either because of a fail mistake or it was induced through a non-disclosure in the context of a duty to disclose, then there is no contract. And that's not to say that they don't have a claim or remedy. If they have a claim or remedy in equity, they can show it. They can show unjust enrichment. But it's not a claim based upon a promissory note.
What exactly is the mistake?
The mistake was in assuming that AMP had the wherewithal to perform.
Didn't AMP own real property in the project?
Yes, but you know, real estate in a developing project is not the same thing as cash. AMP was backed by people who were understood to be quite substantial, and there was no reason to believe that. At least based upon the affidavits we have and the testimony we offered the court, the people on our side had reason to believe that there would be a problem. And they assumed that AMP would pay.
And they if AMP's ability to pay is either based on, you know, people of financial substance upstream, how do you, that was, what's the mistake?
The mistake was that they either were not willing to or able to.
I mean, that's something that happened in, that happened after the fact. You got no evidence that its financial backers were unwilling at the time.
It's not that just that, Your Honor, and I note that I'm running out of time. We have Mr. Powell's email in which 11 days before the agreement is made, he expressly assures and represents that AMP will pay its note.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your time is up, Mr. Eason. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Marcus Gorell, number 9972, appearing on behalf of FFP Development. With me is Chris Mills. The argument of the defendants in this case depends solely on a condition that is not expressed in the documents. And their argument is basically that somehow that condition should be inferred simply because the loan and bulk sale agreement referenced an amendment to the AMP note. And that argument depends on a series of inferences that the defendants would ask the court to make. Let me stop for just a second. I was asked by David Tenner, counsel for Mr. Usom, to advise the court that he's not here today because his client and my client reached a settlement that has not yet been documented, but he asked me to advise you of that, and I should do that.
Okay.
But going back to my argument, the point is that their argument depends on the bulk sale agreement. And when you look at the bulk sale agreement put the loan from FFP to TOI essentially into a box. And in Section 2B of the loan agreement, it defined the loan as the loan from FFP to Trinidad Operations, and then it states explicitly the terms of the loan, including interest thereon, are as set forth in the promissory note. Trinidad Operations shall repay the loan in accordance with the terms set forth in the promissory note. FFP's remedies upon any default in repayment shall be as set forth in the promissory note and deed of trust. So when you look at the sections of the restatement, that particularly section 232 of the restatement, there's essentially a carve-out in the restatement that says that section doesn't apply when it would contradict when the condition to be inferred would be contrary to the express language of the agreement. And here, the express language of the agreement said that at least as to the note, and that's what's at issue here, that's what was enforced, and that's what the judgment was entered on, and the guarantee that supported the note. As to those documents, as to that obligation, the only relevant document for determining the obligations of the parties is the note. And that argument, that section of the loan agreement forecloses the arguments that are being made by the defendants. Stepping back a bit to the phase of their argument about promises. There are a number of agreements recited in or referenced in the loan agreement. Each agreement is self-contained. Each agreement recites the consideration of that the parties were exchanging in exchange in that agreement. And those agreements, even though they're referenced in the loan and bulk sale agreement, stand alone. But setting that aside, it's clear that as to the note, which is at issue here, the parties intended for that note to stand alone and to be enforceable by its terms.
But let's assume that we agree with everything you said on the ambiguity and the no condition. Why would that conclusion foreclose the defendant's position concerning?
Okay. Well, the argument about mistake, I think, presumes that there was a separate agreement or an agreement by AMP to repay the loan as a condition to the loan agreement, and that is simply not the case. AMP did not make any independent promises other than the commitments that it made in two documents.
So there are no new promises on the part of AMP in the loan agreement or its attachments?
Yes, I think by the terms of the agreement, that is true.
Mr. Scorro, what is your response then to Mr. Eason's comment that the amended AMP agreement was a new promise?
Well, it is an amended agreement, but in that agreement, AMP doesn't give anything. It actually gets something. It gets a reduction of the loan. And when you read through the loan and bulk sale agreement, that there's nothing that contradicts that. There's no separate promise by AMP, or no new promise by AMP. And when you look at the there are two documents that really reference AMP. The amendment to the note is a standalone document, and in the parties to that agreement, Stone Ridge and AMP, recite the consideration and lay out what they're doing. The same is true in the memorandum agreement concerning the lots. There, the parties reach agreements as to how those lots will be marketed and how the proceeds will be distributed. And just to go to one of the points Mr. Eason made, clearly AMP had assets. It had lots. It had no property interests in that development. And those lots were the collateral for the loan that Stone Ridge had made to AMP. And, you know, there's certainly no evidence in the record that at the time the loan agreement was executed and at the time the FFP note was executed, that that AMP had no intent to repay the loan.
Record of what the holdings of AMP were worth as of the day?
Direct evidence in terms of someone's testimony or a document? No.
Or what they paid for the lots?
I think you can discern that from the there is a deed of trust, and there is the original AMP loan. And I'm trying to think of the deposition testimony and what of it is actually in the record. But the I believe this is in the record, and I think it's discernible from the deposition testimony by Mr. Powell that was appended or submitted with the plaintiff's response to the motion for summary judgment. AMP properties were sold by Stone Ridge and were secured by the note, but there was additional consideration over and above the note. But I have to say that I believe that's in the record, but it may not be clear. And it certainly wasn't put into issue or specifically put into issue by any document or affidavit submitted by the defendants.
I mean, what exactly was AMP's role in the project? I mean, is it buying lots and then developing them for spec homes to resale, or what?
Yes, that's exactly what it's doing. This is a, by way of context, the Cougar Canyon project is a golf course and residential development in near Trinidad. And Stone Ridge owned some lots, and AMP bought some of those lots. And that, there were various entities involved, some of which were affiliated with FFP and AMP, and others that were affiliated with the guarantors, which is why they were willing to give the guarantor the guarantee. And the loan was made, the FFP loan. We're not denying that the loan was intended to benefit the entire project. But the project itself, AMP's role was as an owner of lots and a developer of lots, and hopefully the seller of lots. And for a variety of reasons, relating to what happened in the economy in 2008, things that people expected didn't happen. But that doesn't, none of that alters the basic structure of the agreement, and none of that is a basis for inferring promises. And, you know, one of the arguments that we made is that when you look at what happened here, this argument was brought to the table very late. It's clear, or at least there's no evidence that it was contemplated that there would be a linkage. You can't discern it from the documents, and you can't discern it from any evidence generated by the defendants that's from a period contemporaneous with the execution of the note, that this was intended. The evidence, I would suggest, shows just the opposite, that it was the intent of the parties, clearly as manifested in Section 2B of the loan and bulk sale agreement, that FFP would be entitled to enforce the note solely on the event of a default under the note with no other preconditions, and that guarantors took on that responsibility and freely did so and knowingly did so, as stated in the guarantee. Unless the court has questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Squirrel. Thank you again, Mr. Easton. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.